This episode is brought to you by Progressive, where drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. Quote now at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Hey everyone, Jody Avergan here, and as you know, the whole crew at This Day does a bunch of other stuff. Can you believe it? Making this show is not a full-time job. And what's more, we really like to celebrate when there are cool new projects coming out that one of us worked on. As it happens, a bunch are coming out over the next couple weeks, so we're going to be spreading the word, starting with the return of You Get a Podcast. This is the show hosted by our very own Kelly Carter Jackson, produced by me, all about Oprah Winfrey and her enormous impact on our culture and politics. There's one incredible season already in the books, and now it is back under a new name, You Get a Podcast. But here's an excerpt from the first episode of the new season, which focuses on the daytime talk show scene in the late 80s and the early 90s. Jerry and Sally and Geraldo and so forth, and the way in which Oprah sprung from that, but then managed to evolve past that scene, going from Oprah 1.0 to Oprah 2.0 to becoming the undisputed queen of talk. It's a very fun episode, and I'm really excited that this show is back for a really great new season. So take a listen to this, and then, of course, subscribe to You Get a Podcast so you can listen to the rest of the episode, the full episode, and get all the new ones as they come out over the next couple months. All right, here's Kelly and her co-host, Leah Wright-Rigger. Here we go.
Probably the pinnacle of all of these scandals, even more than sort of like the chair throwing and fist fights, is in 1995 when Jenny Jones, who another popular daytime talk show host, has on guests who are revealing sort of their secret longtime crushes. And one of her guests reveals that he has had this longtime crush with another man and sort of puts this man on blast by professing his love for him. And the man who he is professing his love to is so outraged by the fact that this gay man would, you know, claim his love for him, that he takes it to a whole nother level and he murders the man who professes his love to him. And this becomes a huge, huge scandal. Also, this becomes a huge court case in which the producers of the Jenny Jones show are found negligent. And, you know, the family of this man who was murdered was awarded $25 million. Listen, that's a lot of money now. That's certainly a lot of money back in the 90s. And this moment freaks everyone out in the talk show world, because it now means that, like, we can be held accountable for a lot of these shenanigans that are being put up on TV. And it's really before this moment that Oprah says, hey, listen, I'm not going down this route. Like, this happens, the murder happens in 95. In 89, Oprah's like, not liking what I'm seeing, and says, I'm starting my pivot, my shift. You know, when they go low, we go high. This is her moment of going high, essentially. And you start to see different conversations coming out of Oprah than what is happening in the rest of the field. And that pivot is really what starts to shift her into what we call Oprah 2.0. And she sort of takes the high road while everyone is still down in the trenches of trash TV.
Right. So we don't have any evidence that Oprah Winfrey cared anything about the Jenny Jones murder, the subsequent trial, the lawsuits, the acquittals, all of that stuff. She never comments on it. It doesn't appear to be part of her orbit. At the same time, we know that Oprah cared about the Jenny Jones murder, trial, payout, acquittal. Everyone did. Everyone, particularly since the first ruling against the Jenny Jones show says you are on the hook for what happens on your show, and now you got to pay. Now, the acquittal overturns that, in part because the court rules that people cannot be responsible for murder that happens on their show, like unanticipated murder as a consequence of their show. So daytime talk kind of lucks out in that respect. But we know, particularly given the brands that these talk shows operate, that they absolutely would have been watching this like a hawk.
Yeah, and nobody's trying to catch a case.
Exactly. It's also true that this is the exact same time that Oprah is evolving. She's evolving her set. She's evolving her color scheme. She's evolving the music on the show. She tries out three different, right, peaceful zen-like theme songs. That are about empowerment and you go.
I think I'm gonna run on.
Right. There's the one with Patti LaBelle where Oprah sings.
Yes.
There's also the one where like it's the jazz version of I'm Every Woman. Right. So there are lots of different versions of the Oprah Winfrey theme song that correlate with her changing. Mm-hmm. And so she makes this pivot in a number of ways. One, she stops going into the audience. The audience is now distant. Mm-hmm. She is the expert. She is offering you a masterclass and a chance to learn at her feet. Literally. Mm. She starts dressing different, right? It's far more sophisticated, softer colors. This is going to sound really crass, but she looks richer. She looks right.
She is richer.
I mean, she is richer. But we see a decline in, like, the colored contacts, the big hair, the big shoulder pads. We see a quite literally refined and slimmed down Oprah Winfrey. She's rocking
and more name brands,
right?
Yeah, high-end designers.
Right? All these designers. And then, like, I think also the color palette of the show, including the set, that iconic set that is now in, you know,
the Blacksonian, the Smithsonian. It's in a museum now. Her sofa set is in a museum.
It's an artifact. And I think it becomes an artifact by like 1993 when she trades up for like two gold seats. And then later for that like beige white couch, she stops moving into the audience. She says, I'm going to talk about body. I'm going to talk about health. I'm going to talk about wellness. I'm going to talk about spirituality. I am done with this trash phase of my life. And I am a new person. I have emerged as a different person. So there are all these aesthetic markers. And then she mixes it up, I think, with different kinds of topics. So while she's not, again, broadcasting like an abortion on television, she's still doing stuff that we might perceive as a little trashy, right? She is doing a wagon of fat. She is like, you know, quite literally pulling out a representation of the body fat that she has lost. People tune in for that. They want to see that. Yeah.
So she's doing like a warning sign show, or my gosh, one of the most powerful shows when she talked about like child molestation, and she put out like images of FBI pictures of people that were known sort of sexual offenders. And a couple of people actually got caught. Like people were like, that's my neighbor. You know, like she was doing things that felt edgy for sure, but also had like a tinge of progressiveness about it, that people would, it was almost as though people were trying to get more information and she was trying to be like, did you know, give you that kind of edge.
And just a quick story. I just recently read this really wonderful book by Patricia Turner called I Heard It Through the Grapevine. And it's about like rumor and conspiracy in Black communities. This is me putting my academic hat on. But one of the things that she points out is that like by 1989, Oprah is so popular that there is a prevalent rumor in Black communities that is repeated by not just ordinary everyday people in these communities, but like Spike Lee is going around repeating it. And that's that Oprah Winfrey had Liz Claiborne on her show and that Liz Claiborne was like, my clothes are not made for Black people. And Oprah Winfrey was like, I can't have a racist on my show. Get off. And Oprah took a stand. And the Oprah Winfrey people were like, that didn't happen. That has like never, ever happened. Like there's not even like a secret show where that happened. Right. But Spike Lee is still like, that happened. Right. And Black people are still like, that happened. But she has attained this like level of preeminence that people are creating myths around her. And so when she pivots in 1989, right, and says, I'm not doing this anymore. I'm not doing the tabloid. I'm not doing the trash. Like, I'm rethinking the entire Oprah brand. I think she has enough clout that it not only sustains her, but it propels her to the front of the pack.
Mm-hmm, for sure.
Hey there, Jody here, and I'm excited to tell you that one of our favorite Radiotopia siblings, Ear Hustle, is back with a brand new season. This is their 13th season, and the show just keeps getting better. Now, I don't know if you know, but Ear Hustle is the show about life inside prison, but it is not your typical prison podcast. Co-hosts Nigel Poor and Erlon Woods have recently been spending time at four California prisons, and now they have a season's worth of funny, surprising, and unforgettable stories to share. In a recent episode, they were able to visit a groundbreaking prison hospice where they spoke to men who are grappling with the reality of dying inside prison. Also coming up this season are stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells, complicated mom-daughter relationships inside prison, and stories of incarcerated people who wonder whether they've become too comfortable behind bars. These are stories about life on the inside told by those who live it. I'll be listening, and I hope you will too. Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
What I also think is wild about this moment is, you know, we said Ginny Jones happens in 1995. In 1995, there is a New York Times article that is talking about sort of this tabloid TV. And it says, quote, "Apologists for the more salacious talk shows like to say that Miss Winfrey's ratings slipped after she declared she would take the high road in the subject matter. They say viewers switched away from Oprah in their desire to see more sexual escapades, violence, and drug abuse. But Oprah has been the number one talk show for 10 straight years. So in November of 1995, her show had an 8.4 ratings, where Ginny Jones was second with 4.9. Ooh. So it's not even close, right? It's not even close.
So and here's Oprah Winfrey out here being like, oh, look at my fabulousness.
I mean, this is when so many things happened in the 90s for Oprah. You get the most famous or maybe infamous interview with Michael Jackson. She gives that in 1993. You start to see her engaging with more celebrities that come on her show. People want to hear from all of, you know, the big people who are in Hollywood, the latest film that comes out. It's in 2000 that she starts her magazine. So that's when you get like, I'm not just a talk show host. I now have a magazine. You know, in 2003, she becomes an official billionaire, the first Black woman billionaire. You get the Angel Network. You get the book club. Like, there's so much about her that is expanding.
Her favorite things.
Her favorite things
come out. My favorite things. It's the gold standard.
Yes, yes. She's so much more than a talk show host.
Right.
She establishes
herself as a tastemaker, as a gatekeeper, and I think someone who doesn't have her finger on the culture, she is the culture. And that is, I think, powerful. Now, does that mean that Oprah is not still engaging in exploitation? I don't think so. I just don't think that it has the trashy aesthetic of nearly every other show that's on television. And it's also remarkable to watch that even after the explosion of trashy daytime talk shows, Oprah actually inspires, I think, a different kind of daytime talk show, like the launch of something like The Rosie O'Donnell Show in 1996. The Rosie O'Donnell Show, which runs for 6 years, is absolutely not trashy tabloid TV. Right. Mm-hmm. It's more about like feel good, fun.
Yeah.
Women.
And giveaways. Right? Giveaways is all of the
funny. Rosie O'Donnell is a comedian.
Yeah.
And I think that is a
And you go to these shows to get stuff. Do you know what I mean? And I feel like, you know, if there was a musical artist on, you got their CD, you know, underneath your seat. There's also something I think that's interesting that, like, while Jerry Springer sort of gives birth or rise to Steve Wilkos, when you think about Oprah and her, like, spinoff children, you know, she launches, you know, Dr. Phil and Bob Green and Susie Orman and Nate Berkus and Rachel Ray and, you know, all of these people that come on her show either get their own shows or get their own sort of fame and stardom. But it's done in a way where it's cloaked in positivity. It's cloaked in maybe a much more progressive or forward thinking. This is how you live your best life moment. Like, people are using these shows as aspiration, right?
Yes.
As something that they want to improve themselves, as opposed to watching trash TV and feeling superior to the people who are on those shows. You know, I could look at Jerry Springer or Montel Williams and be like, I'm not as bad as them. But you watch Oprah and you're like, oh, snap, I need to be like them. And that, I think, is the difference for the people who come on.
Right. And so, you know, it's I think it's complex. She, as part of Oprah 2.0, she shifts her focus, but also solidifies herself as a talk show host for white middle class audiences. They love her, and her show is really tailored around those things that I think appeal to that kind of audience. But Kelly, you're right. Because it is aspirational, even as her audience is right and her focus is directed at a white middle class audience, Oprah 2.0 still has that aspirational element that allows her to have an audience that is also poor and working class. So it's like it's really nuanced in this moment.
To me, like, I think it's interesting that sort of whiteness and capitalism really work hand in hand with the show. When you think about the fact that early 1.0 Oprah, she's very much like the Black woman host, and her audience is diverse, and Black women are loving her. Black women still love her.
Yes.
But by the time you get to the 2000s, Black women are a little like, they're a little upset. You know, they love Oprah. But if they had a bone to pick, it would be that she no longer felt like their champion, or no longer felt like she was speaking to them. I will say that. When she has, you know, certain conversations on her show, it does feel like it's geared more toward women who can stay at home, women who are not just middle class, but maybe upper middle class. When you see her sitting on her show and, you know, you're looking at the bottom of her heels because it's probably a red bottom or a Christian Louboutin, there are certain fashion elements that were just, you know, in some ways so unattainable, maybe aspirational, but practically unattainable to a lot of the people who are watching her show. But also the people that she promotes, when we think about your Bob Green, your Nate Berkus, your Dr. Phil, your doctors, these are not, you know, Black experts. Aside from Gail, there's not too many people in Oprah's life that reflect elements of the Black experience that feel universal. And I think people resented her for that, resented the fact that she wasn't putting on a lot of Black people.
I think she understands this, right? I know she's aware of this, even if she doesn't speak on it. One, because she's a quiet investor in a number of Black educational, right, aspirational things. And we had an entire show on this, right? Her quiet investment in something like A Better Chance. She actually has a Better Chance Scholars on her show during the Oprah 2.0 period.
Sending men to Morehouse, sending men HBCUs, to Morehouse,
funding their education. But I think she tries to get at it in really distinct ways that allow her to, you know, give a head nod to her Blackness while also not alienating that white middle class audience. And one of the ways she does it is by highlighting somebody like Toni Morrison. You know, she's has Toni Morrison on the show several times. So it's like, how do I make Blackness palatable to my white audiences? And how do I show them that it's fun, it's safe, it's rewarding, it's important. And there are a couple of moments where she's a lot rawer than that, particularly when she's talking about her own history, like her own sexual history, her assault history, growing up as a Black woman, when she meets her, you know, her sister, which we also did an episode on.
We did an episode
on that too, tune in.
Yeah, but I think all those episodes come later in the Oprah Winfrey Show. Like, I think by the time you get to the 2000s, certainly mid to late 2000s, she is the queen, bar none. There is no one left on the scene. The only one that probably comes close is Ellen DeGeneres.
Right.
And it's different because Ellen is a comedian and, you know, she's having a different experience when you're in the audience with her. She's dancing. You know, she starts out the show dancing up and down the aisle. That's not something that Oprah would do. I think there's maybe an age demographic in, like, who's watching Oprah versus who's watching Ellen DeGeneres to some extent. But there's a different level of engagement that she has where she can be very choosy about who she has on her show. And the aspiration is, you know, like you were saying earlier, if Jerry Springer calls you and says, we want you on our show, it's like, no, no, you don't want to do that. But if Oprah calls and says, we want you on the show, your career has just been made. But I do think that, you know, there was a moment in which you really could not be Oprah. Right. And if you wanted to be Oprah, you had to say at the start of the show, I'm trying to be Oprah, just right. like Tyra Banks does.
The daytime chat format is also dying too, right? So while we, you know, while we have these really giant like network talk shows that are stables like the Today Show, Good Morning America, you know, CBS This Morning, other shows like The Chew, gone, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
The Real, gone. Right? The View is still the gold standard, but the talk is hanging in there, but it's hanging in by a thread. This used to be a landscape that was littered mm-hmm. with, you know, like dozens of talk shows. You turned on the TV. Who is it? Carney Wilson.
Oh, yes.
Wilson Phillips. Yes. She has her own talk show during this period.
Rolanda. Anybody remember Rolanda? Rolanda. She was a black woman that also had a show as well. There were some randos that
everybody had a show. Everybody had a show in the 90s, right?
But what I think is incredible is that by the time you get to the 2000s, it's really just Oprah. It's ultimately mm-hmm. when she takes that stance in 1989 and decides I'm not going down this road anymore and backpedals up a whole nother stream. That's sort of the end of it to some extent. Like her taking the high road really leads all these other shows into oblivion. I mean, like, yeah, okay, Jerry Springer has 30 seasons, which is incredible when you think about that. But it's like, but who's watching? Do you know what I mean? It comes on at like 1 a.m. or whatever, or it's like, it's not prime time anymore. It's certainly not something people are discussing. It's actually something that might be considered a little publicly shameful to say that you watch Jerry Springer, certainly in its 23rd season or whatever. You weren't saying that. And yeah, I think Oprah comes out on top.
It's undeniable that Oprah comes out on top. But one thing that Oprah also does is that we've had shows on this in our previous season, is that she gives platforms to people that I would call trashy. I think most people would agree that they are trashy. So the king of daytime talk for a very long time, Dr. Phil, there's a shift in his show where he goes from this kind of self-help, you know, spiritual stuff to employing the production staff of the Jerry Springer Show.
Wow.
So is that trash TV coming full circle?
I mean, you know, Dr. Phil was on the air for mm-hmm. a very, very long time.
His ratings
and Dr. Oz's ratings were number one and number two, especially after Oprah is mm-hmm. no longer on the scene. What I think is interesting, though, too, is that you start to see the subtle ways on Oprah's show in which some of what we talk about as like deviant behavior or controversial ideas, that line gets blurred, softened, becomes a little bit more seductive. There's some interviews I just remember about Oprah doing, like the Jenny McCarthy and vaccines. Like there is, you know, when she pushed the secret and, you know, sort of these name it and claim it ideas. There is a lot of those, I think, frameworks that get cloaked in acceptability, but they're really, really problematic when you start to peel back the layers. I mean, Dr. Oz, we've talked about this before. Dr. Oz comes on, legitimate cardiologist. But then you start to hear some of the things that he says on the show and you're like, wait a second.
Quite literally selling snake oil.
Right? Yes. Like, yes.
Selling snake oil.
There are some ways in which she takes herself out of that picture. And then there are other ways in which you see her perpetually dipping her toe in the cesspool that is problematic ideas, problematic conversations, problematic people.
Right. It's complex. The only people who are allowed to do trash TV during the daytime are people that Oprah has endorsed. But what happens is I think as daytime TV, trash TV dies off, it migrates. It shifts into reality TV.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So reality TV emerges right around like 2001, 2003, but it's always been relegated to the evening, right? Prime time. So we get Survivor, The Great Race, which is like really gentle, but then we get The Simple Life, right?
We get The Real World.
We get Rich Girls.
The Bachelor, right? The Bachelorette.
We get Flavor of Love.
Oh my right? God. We get The Real Housewives of Pick a City.
Right? Pick a City. Right?
And literally.
It's also true that because it is, I think, late night, it is easier for people to talk about, right? And to say, I'm a fan of this show, right? It's because it's salacious, but it's relegated to the nighttime.
It's easier for people to consume because in the 90s, as women are going back to work more in larger and larger numbers, the ability for people to be at home at 3 o'clock, at 4 o'clock to consume this kind of TV is not there. And so everyone's typically home in the evenings to be able to watch TV. Right. I will also say that and this is later, but like TiVo, DVR, the ability to record TV to watch it later is also something that is a big part of that as well. Choosing when you watch.
Yeah.
I know that when I watched most of Oprah, it was at 4 p.m. But when I was in grad school, she came on again at 12:45. She came on again about 1 a.m. and I almost always, because I was just a night owl, watched her again at 1 a.m. So, but the ability to be able to choose when you watch, I think, is a huge part of that.
But I will say she reigns supreme. There is no competition. Even Ellen DeGeneres isn't able to pull off the queen of talk, despite her many years, nearly two decades on television, right? Ellen DeGeneres ends her show in scandal and disappointment. And so I think, Oprah Winfrey is the undeniable queen of talk.
So hopefully that gives you a sense of how Oprah has shifted over the years. And if you hear us refer to Oprah 1.0 and 2.0 and even 3.0, you'll know what we're talking about. We did a lot of that in the first season. We did a lot of episodes on some of the moments we mentioned in this episode. So please go check those out. And this coming season, we'll be talking about Oprah episodes from all over the map. We're doing the infamous Forsyth, Georgia show. Remember that, Leo? We're doing Oprah's relationship with hip-hop.
Also yikes. Also yikes.
Oprah's relationship with Gayle. And their
amazing.
Iconic, yes, their road trip together. Their
amazing,
road trip from
iconic.
California to New York.
Aspirational. Everything you want in a friendship.
Yes, and a sisterhood, a real sisterhood. So that's what's coming up in our new set of episodes. We cannot wait. We hope that you join us. Tell a friend. Make sure you subscribe to the show. Share the show. Visit the website. Thanks for listening. Class dismissed.
Peace out.
That's the bell. Class dismissed.
Back to the books. Back to the stacks.
You Get a Podcast is a proud member of Radiotopia from PRX, a network of independent, listener-supported, artist-owned podcasts. Special thanks to Audrey and Yuri and everyone at Radiotopia. Remember, sign up for our newsletter, send us an email, follow us on Twitter and Instagram. You can find out more and help support the show on our website at yougetapodcast.com. You Get a Podcast is a production of Roulette Productions. Our executive producer is Jody Avergan. Our producer is Nina Ernest. Our beautiful artwork is by Jonathan Conda. I'm Kelly Carter Jackson.
And I'm Leah Wright Rigger.
See you next time.
Radiotopia.